Go Strategic is pleased to present the School of Kingdom Citizenship. This teaching is entitled Critical Thinking by Dr. Simon Mold.
Well, welcome to this session on critical thinking in the information age. I am so excited to share this topic with you. I've been dealing with this subject of helping the next generation to be able to craft the skill of being able to think critically in the world in which we live, where we are surrounded by so much information, so much narrative, so much spin, so many theories, so many conspiracy theories, that the ability to wade through all of that and to be able to decipher what is true from what is false, what is helpful from what is not helpful, I think is going to be absolutely crucial. And in particular, I think about amazing examples that we have from scripture, like Daniel and Esther and Joseph, who lived in very worldly situations. And in order to do their job, they had to be able to understand the times in which they lived. And they did so, and they were effective in that arena, predominantly because the Holy Spirit gave them the ability to be able to think through the issues critically and not just kind of buy in to what anybody and everybody was saying or wanted even them to say. And so I'm hoping that we're going to be able to get some tools today and see from a biblical perspective why critical thinking in this day and age, I think, is so imperative. But before we do that, I think it's great that we start on a strong biblical foundation. So I want to read a couple of scriptures to you. First of all, Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit according to human tradition. Now, you'd think that, oh, you know, I'm not going to be taken captive by philosophy because I'm not taking philosophy courses from some kind of secular institution. Well, there are many different carriers of philosophy into our culture today. We see the carriers of philosophy through news narratives and through movies and through various other aspects of culture. And I think for us to be aware that the environment in which we find ourselves, where information is so abundant that it is oftentimes utilized as carriers of philosophy that would seek to take us captive. And so our job is to ensure that we have the mindset ability to be able to think critically so that we can spot those philosophies where and when it's important to do so. Another key scripture for me, particularly in these more recent times, is 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 20 and 21. And Paul is admonishing Timothy, saying, protect what has been entrusted to you, avoiding worldly empty chatter and the opposing arguments of what is falsely called knowledge, which some have professed and thereby have gone astray from the faith. I think that's really interesting that he is talking about being in a situation where there's so much empty chatter going on and arguments that are based around false knowledge. I think as we look at what is taking place in our world, particularly from a cultural standpoint and a political standpoint, and I don't want to say that one side is worse than the other, but I definitely am a firm believer that both sides, on the right and also on the left, are into creating a ton of different false narratives and misinformation and even, of course, conspiracy theories as well. And that many Christians oftentimes will get swept up into those things because they are so enticing. And what Paul is saying here is avoid worldly empty chatter. We've got to give ourselves to sound thinking where we can think clearly and respectfully about what is going on. The last one, Romans chapter 12, verse 2, scripture I think we're all very familiar with. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may be able to discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. I love how, you know, this scripture focuses on, yeah, be transformed by the renewal of your mind. And I think as Christians, sometimes we can think that, you know, we can just kind of pray for one another at the altar and we can just kind of get this renewal of our mind that just kind of happens instantaneously. And I think that that can happen. But notice what it says in the second half of this verse, that by testing, you may be able to discern what is the will of God. And that is what I'm hoping that we're going to be able to deal with today, is giving you the skill sets and what you need to be able to engage in that imperative task of testing and discerning what is going on, so that we can frame that within the context of God's will and God's way for what he has for mankind. So that's ultimately what we're going to be getting to today as we get on further into this and talk about some of the skill sets that are going to be involved in developing that ability to think critically. But before we do that, I want to talk about why this is so necessary, particularly in the realm of where we find ourselves today in this information age. I want to begin by quoting Winston Churchill, one of my favorite people in history. Of course, I am British. Winston Churchill was the British Prime Minister during World War II. At a time when world civilization was in a crisis mode, not only dealing with the political and the military struggles that were taking place, but those political and military struggles ultimately were the result of a significant battle for culture that was taking place as a result of ideologies, the Nazi ideology, the fascist ideology that was taking over in places like Germany and Japan. And Winston Churchill, who had a reputation for being able to see through just the kind of the noise and the clatter of what was kind of taking place in the present, and be able to see beyond that at the 100,000 foot level as to what actually was taking place, and call things for what they actually were. And in the midst of the war in 1943, he made a trip to the United States of America and spoke to a bunch of Harvard University graduates. And in that context, rather than dealing with the specifics of what he and Roosevelt were dealing with in terms of all that was unfolding, the logistics of the war and how things were going, instead he realized that his audience was future thinkers and leaders in the United States of America. And what they needed was not looking at the particulars of what's happening right now, but ultimately what was going to be unfolding in this new era that hopefully they would secure if they were going to continue to be successful in fighting against Germany and Japan, which of course they know they were able to. And in the midst of his address, he made this very astute observation. He said this: the empires of the future are the empires of the mind. The empires of the future are the empires of the mind. What a thing to say, you know, decades before the dawn of the computer era, decades before the dawning of the information age, when all he could see was at that particular day and era, it still was very much the era of empires, of political empires. I mean, he presided over the British Empire at that time and hoped that that still would remain intact at the end of the war. And of course, we knew that that was about to completely fall apart. But the reality was that Churchill saw something particularly profound, and that was that the future was going to be defined by ideological ideas of the mind, rather than political structures of industry and commerce. Okay. The reality is that we live in an information era. We've been born into it. Those of us who particularly who are, you know, under the age of 50, perhaps, there's been never an era that we have not understood as to be one that is profoundly impacted by the role of information. In fact, Gen Z, the latest generation at this point in time, is the first generation whose whole life experience to date coincides with the predominance of big data, information, social media. They were born in the late 90s and the early 2000s, in the era of the personal computer. And since then, their whole life has been shaped by the reality of the information age. Just think, in the average 24 hours that the Gen Z person experiences in today's day and era, there are approximately 329 million terabytes of information that is generated every single day. I don't know how much information can be stored in an iPhone, but I know that in a powerful laptop, maybe 1 terabyte of information is stored. And yet we're creating, as a society, 329 million of those, not the devices, but information that can fill those devices every single day. Every day, 333 billion emails are sent. 8.5 billion Google searches are made. 3.5 billion snaps on Snapchat. 2.5 billion pieces of content on Facebook. And on and on and on it goes. And if you think about it, since Gen Z has kind of come of age, you know, 10 years or so ago, and how much information has been created in the last 10 to 15 years or so, it's been an enormous amount of information that is created on a day-to-day basis, on a year-to-year basis, and collectively since that time. And yet the reality is that with all that information, 90% of it was created just in the last 24 months alone. Okay. So we're seeing this massive kind of incline here in terms of the amount of information that is being produced and consumed every single day that contributes to this kind of sense, almost, I think, of being kind of completely overwhelmed, where we are in this information age, and ultimately we have to ask ourselves the question, but is it actually producing a greater level of understanding and wisdom? We'll get to that later. The reality is that information today, data today, is what some refer to as the new oil. Now, what do I mean by the new oil? Like oil is something that we used to be, you know, interested in? Well, yes. Back in Churchill's day, back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, one of the most significant commodities that drove the economic engine of the West was the possession of oil. If you had oil, you had energy. If you had energy, you had economic capacity. And so what people are saying when they're saying that data is the new oil, information is the new oil, what we're saying is that the possession and the ability to produce and the ability to disseminate information is now the ability to have power in our economy. And so in that sense, information is like currency. It gives us the capacity to get what we want. It gives us the ability to have, to acquire, and also to project power. Without information, there is no ability to have power in this information age. Information is utilized to win the competitive edge and gain economic power in our economy today. We use algorithms all the time to discover the personal browsing interests of individuals and to promote specifically tailored products to them so that we can sell them things. In addition to that, information today is manipulated in order to create narratives and fuel bias so that we can garner people's votes and gain political power over them. In addition to that, information today is evaluated on a personal level so that it supports my choices, my narratives, my desires, my sense of what I'm trying to create out of my life. And as a result, we project psychological power from having information that we can manipulate and control. And so in that regard, information is currency. We use it, we trade with it, and we leverage it in order to get what we want. Now, to use this analogy of currency, I think it's important because, like any other currency, the value of currency goes up and down depending on the supply of that currency and the demand of that currency. When there is a massive supply of a particular currency, the value of it tends to drop. Like the supply of anything, if we flood the market with I don't know, say pencils or flowers or something that maybe not everybody wants, then we get too much of it and the value of those things goes down in order for the suppliers to be able to get rid of it. Okay. Now think of it in terms of information as a commodity that has value because people want that information. As we begin to flood the market with more and more information, more and more content, more and more narratives, more and more information that is being produced by the media and by education and so on and so forth, the value of it, sadly, is going down because it is not attributed to actually creating value in people's lives. So the paradox, then, of the information age that we live in is that information is beginning to live and exist in a vacuum of understanding and wisdom. It's understanding and wisdom that's attributed to the knowledge, to the information that actually gives it value. And when information and when knowledge is stripped of understanding and wisdom, it begins to lose its value. That's the greatest paradox of our time, where we have this influx of wisdom and we have a decrease in understanding and knowledge, and wisdom. And as a result of that, we live in a world where we become more and more dependent on the information producers. And of course, the reality is today that with AI and machines and robots and so on, they are the ones that are programmed by elites, by those who have a high degree of understanding, and they do the hard work of thinking for us. And so the more we rely on those technologies, I'm not saying that they're wrong, they have their place, and we need to utilize them and learn how to leverage them. But if we come to rely on them to do the work of critical thinking for us, then we can become subject to the manipulation of the knowledge creators. What we need to recognize and understand if we want to be those that engage in the task of critical thinking is we need to understand, well, where is the place in which critical thinking happens? Okay. In our ability to engage critical thinking, where does that take place? And it takes place up here in terms of our attention. What is it that we give our attention to where we are able to start thinking critically and using a level of discernment that takes our attention? There is no way that critical thinking can occur, discernment can occur, the ability to have an understanding occur, the ability to be able to receive and process and apply wisdom, that cannot occur without us giving attention to the information that we are consuming. The reality is, sadly, that the information barrage that has been unleashed upon us ultimately is what is vying for our attention constantly throughout the course of our day. There is an inverse relationship, I think, between the information abundance that we're experiencing and the wisdom scarcity that we are actually experiencing also. And that is because we have such a limited attention span where we're engaging in the process of critical thinking. Our attention is where information is processed through the task of critical thinking. And I think that ultimately the things that we perceive as being irrelevant are quickly disregarded because we're just so bombarded all the time with so much information. We just disregard anything that we conceive as being irrelevant. And therefore, we only focus our attention on the things that we think are going to provide us with what we need, what we want, the things that are going to justify our decisions, justify our actions, our self-interest, whether those things are good or bad. Former Google strategist James Williams noted, and I think he succinctly kind of states what I'm trying to say here. He says, when information becomes abundant, attention becomes a scarce resource. Okay. Many of you think in terms of in economic terms. And scarce resources is obviously what economics is all about in terms of managing scarce resources. And we think of those scarce resources as physical materials that we have to manage. Well, our attention span, in that sense, is also a limited resource. It has the capacity to operate within the confines of a quantity of time. And so we have to allocate certain amounts of time for our attention to be working and thinking around an issue. And therefore, it is a scarce resource. And so the more and more information becomes abundant, the more and more our mind is fragmented in trying to figure out what is the meaning of this information and how can it be utilized to develop something of value by turning it into understanding and wisdom. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Herbert Simon in 1971, which was in the very early days of the information age, he said this: in an information-rich world, the wealth of information means a dearth of something else, a scarcity of whatever information consumes. And that information consumes the attention of its recipients. Hence, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. That's an interesting way of kind of framing it. It's like a zero-sum game. The more information we get, potentially, the less amount of attention that we're actually able to apply to that information and derive and mine out of that information understanding and wisdom. So the question I think we have to ask ourselves when we talk about attention and we use the phrase pay attention, we have to ask ourselves the question, well, what is it that we pay when we pay attention? Because our attention is finite, we can only pay attention to a limited number of things. Proverbs teaches us that wisdom and understanding and knowledge are our treasures. And like any treasure, you've got to work for it. You've got to dedicate resources to it. And those resources for us in terms of engaging in the essential task of critical thinking is that it takes time, it takes labor, it takes focus, and it takes tuning out the noise so that we can truly begin to mine the information that we know is going to provide us with value. The reality is that we live in a world where our attention span can be distracted by so many things. Because of our fallen nature, our mental attention is too often directed towards vanity and entertainment and wondering and self-doubt and all those different things rather than generating ideas that create value. Okay. In fact, I would even go even a little further, particularly around the realm of social media. Our attention span is often given to watching others be devalued rather than figuring out how we're going to give our attention to creating value. Okay. There's a whole nother thing to think about there in terms of how people are being devalued on social media. Jonathan Haidt, who's quite a well-known social commentator, he wrote the book, The Coddling of the American Mind. He said, this is one reason social media has been so transformative. There is always an audience eager to watch people being shamed, particularly when it's so easy for spectators to join in and pile on. What an interesting thought, okay? So easy to watch people being shamed. And of course, now social media with the ability to like and reshare and to post and so on. By doing so, we join in and we just pile on all the shaming that's going on in our culture as a result of the social media platforms and things of that nature, okay? This fusing, another quote here from Tom Nichols, who writes the book, The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. He says it this way: this fusing of entertainment, news, punditry, and citizen participation is a chaotic mess that does not inform people so much as it creates the illusion of being informed. The illusion of being informed. Isn't it ironic that despite the massive quantity of information that we can get from thought leaders and mainstream media, alternative media, experts and podcasters and all this kind of stuff. We actually can create the illusion of being informed just because we are surrounded with such an abundance of information. And as a result, we become consumers, I think, in this day and age, of poorly sourced information that is so easy to find on social media. If paying attention requires work, okay, I think human nature is such that it wants to look for the easiest way possible to get the information that satisfies my already preconceived beliefs of what I want to choose to believe that's going to justify my actions, my agenda, my desires, my outlook on life, and all the rest of it. And of course, there's an abundance of places that we can turn to that's going to provide us with that sense of security and provide us with legitimacy around what it is and validation of our preconceived ideas of what it is that we want to hold on to. Okay. The reality is we're looking to so many poor quality sources of information and news. Okay. Just looking at the chart that I have here on news consumption by social media, obviously we know that vast quantities of our society today are utilizing those platforms, and many use them for very good reasons. But look at the inner circle there, the darker circle, where it shows just how many people are looking to Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and TikTok and so on as their source of news. Over 30% looking for Facebook for news. 26% looking to YouTube as a kind of a purveyor of news. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't go to those places and get some insight, see what people are thinking and so on and so forth. But if those are our sole sources because they happen to be so easy and convenient, then I think we rob ourselves of the opportunity to actually engage in the harder task of being able to think for ourselves more critically. The consequence of this, poor sources of information with a lack of attention to analyze, it's gonna create confusion. It's gonna create a myriad of different voices where we no longer have the ability to actually even determine any longer, well, what actually is true. We live in the greatest world of confusion, despite we have access to the most information we've ever had. Okay. And so where do we blame? Instead of recognizing our lack of critical thinking, we blame others for the lies that we choose to believe or the confusion that we live in. It's the government, it's the mainstream media, it's these sales, you know, sharks or whatever. It's always somebody else is to blame for the confusion that I happen to live in, okay? Rather than recognizing, well, actually, maybe you didn't do your homework. And as a result of blaming everybody else, the result is that we now can't trust anybody. We can't trust the government. We can't trust the scientists. We can't trust the experts. We can't trust the CEOs. We can't trust the educators. We can't trust the pastors either, okay? Because they're so blindly following, whatever theory it is that's going to lead to church growth and all the rest of it, and not really concerned about the needs of the sheep, right? We just don't know who to trust any longer in our society today, despite the preponderance of information that is available to us. Okay. And so let's take a look at why it is that we distrust the knowledge curators. I think this is important because before we talk about learning how to discern what's going on and how we understand information, we got to have an understanding of the root of our distrust towards those that are producing information. There's a huge distrust of the establishment in our society today, particularly among those who tend to be a little bit more leaning on the right of the political spectrum. Established leaders are just not trusted to tell us the truth. This statistic was produced by the Edelman Trust, who every year does research on where trust is being formulated or undermined in our culture today. And you'll notice here from these statistics, and these are global statistics, these are not American, these are global statistics, 63% of those who were polled in this survey say that they are not able to trust government leaders. 61%. Actually, if you look at the statement at the bottom, it says here that establishment leaders not trusted to tell us the truth. That business leaders, 61% of business leaders are purposely trying to mislead people by saying things they know are false or gross exaggerations. We believe that 61% of business leaders are trying to mislead us. 63% of government leaders, we think, are trying to exaggerate or mislead us in some way. 64% of journalists and reporters are purposely trying to mislead us through gross exaggerations. Now, whether or not that is true, it doesn't matter. It's the perception that really matters. It's the perception that we are not able to trust the establishment that means that we are now overturning every rock and looking anywhere for information that is going to justify my preconceived idea that I'm not willing to budge from. And this is the kind of culture that we live in because it's been fueled by this postmodernist idea that you are the purveyor of your own reality. You are the one who defines your own truth. You can be your own cultural citizen expert, okay? And as much as that's a wonderful thing to empower the individual, but to recognize, or to, excuse me, to take on this idea that I have a greater capacity to understand what's going on than maybe somebody who really is an authority, okay? And so what we've done is that everyone's opinion now must be accepted as being equal in value to everybody else's. And I recognize that in a democracy in particular, everyone's opinion is valid. But that doesn't mean that everybody's opinion is equal, okay, in terms of value, right? You can, it's valid for you to have a stupid opinion, if I can say that bluntly, right, and in a friendly tone, right? It's valid for you to have a stupid opinion, but guess what? If your opinion is stupid, it's probably not worth much. It's not really valuable, okay? But we've moved away from all opinions being equally valid to now where all opinions are equally valid and equally valued, okay? And as a result, we've undermined the trust of the established knowledge experts. Not only do we question the knowledge from the established experts, but we've even grown to not only reject it, but also disdain it. Tom Nichols, again, in his book, The Death of Expertise, he says, maybe the intellectual gulf between the educated elites and the masses is now so large that they simply cannot talk to each other except to exchange expressions of mutual contempt. And I think that's really where we've landed in our world today. And I think that there's actually genuine reasons as to why the elite can't be trusted. There's an attitude of elitism that we know better, and they have a patronizing attitude towards those that maybe are less educated or aren't a part of the established elite. These established elite have disconnected themselves oftentimes from ordinary people and their problems, and they fail to understand the reality of living and the difficulties of trying to just basically make it in the middle class today, okay? The pressures on the middle class are greater than ever before, and oftentimes the elite fail to understand that. In addition, there's a failure to recognize the overarching sense of bias that exists in the academic and in the mainstream media that is so tilted towards the left, that just ordinary people that are mainstream, you know, slightly right of center, feel ostracized and left out, and therefore the ability to trust any longer what these people in the academic and mainstream media becomes more and more difficult. As a result, the fruit of this distrust is that we are seeing the eroding of knowledge in our information age. A quote here, again, this is one of the reasons why few Americans trust what little news they watch. Too many people approach the news with an underlying assumption that they are already well-versed in the issues. I don't need some expert. I can figure it all out for myself. They don't seek information so much as confirmation. And when they receive information they don't like, they will gravitate to sources that they prefer because they believe others are mistaken or even lying. Okay, this is what happens when we live in a culture of distrust. It means that I'm going to continue looking for the information until I find that which I feel comfortable with, and we don't actually challenge ourselves. And of course, the result is we produce a division in culture between the us and the them, the majority and the elite. The small people that can control the masses, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, let's shift gears here and start talking a little bit about what it means to actually develop these skill sets that are involved in thinking critically in this age of distrust. Okay, and I say that very distinctively in an age of distrust. I could have said in the information age, which it is the information age, but more importantly, in this age of distrust. Because I think that it is these very skills that we're going to be talking about that is what will bring about the reestablishment of trust, whereby those in the elite, right, that we're hoping to be able to express something to and say, actually, no, we do have a voice at the table. We do have something meaningful to say. We do have something valuable to say. That it is because we have the ability to think critically and use these skills that I think we're going to be able to reestablish some trust. We might not be able to trust them, but that doesn't matter in one sense, okay? The issue is that we're wanting a place at the table, and so we're the ones that need to be trusted. And frankly, you know, they've looked at us oftentimes and think, we've been called the deplorables by Hillary Clinton. We've been called, the uneducated masses or what have you by the intellectual elite. And I think what we need to do is part of the responsibility we need to actually own for ourselves, because we have shortcut our thinking and look for the quick and easy way out, and we've bought into information that is so cheap to find based on social media or all the way down to conspiracy theories. And instead, we need to become those who actually have a credible way of deriving not only the information, but processing it so that we add to it the value of understanding and wisdom. And so that's why we're talking about providing wisdom and critical thinking in an age of distrust. The model that I want to look to is Daniel. And I think it's so important because Daniel found himself in a world that is very similar to ours. He was in the intellectual capital of the ancient world at that time. That's what Babylon was. And he was surrounded, of course, with the intellectual elite of his day. But it's interesting because when the king, Nebuchadnezzar, is confronted with the problem of having dreams in the night that are keeping him up, and he doesn't know what they mean, and he wants to gather all the intellectual elite around him to discern what that dream is and what it could mean and all that, ultimately, he could not trust the elite to do it. And we know that because he says to them, he says, listen, I don't want you to just kind of pontificate and be talking heads and just kind of tell me, your vain idea and conspiracy as to what it is that these dreams mean. He says, I want you to tell me the dream and the interpretation because I don't trust you. And I can only trust those who actually have a spiritual quality of being able to discern what the dream is and its interpretation. Okay, so the intellectual elite could not be trusted. And Daniel realized that God could give him the opportunity to be able to have that ability to sow trust back into the king of Babylon. All right, let's take a look at some of Daniel's intellectual virtues that I think is particularly important that we have in this day and era. The first one is curiosity, which is a disposition to wonder and ask why. Ask the why question and wonder about things. I love how when we look at the story unfolding in this early part of the book of Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar had had his dreams, and there's all this talk about, you know, annihilating the intellectual elite for not being able to provide the answers to him. And the captain of the king's guard is seemingly in this hurry to kind of get to the bottom of what's going on. And Daniel comes to the king and he said, why is this decree so urgent? Okay. There was a sense of wanting to uncover things. There was a disposition of curiosity in Daniel. I need to know what's going on. I want to understand what it is that the king is worried about. I'm curious. I'm not only interested in intellectually understanding the nature of the dream, but from an emotional intelligence perspective, I want to know what is bothering the king. Why is this such an urgent issue? I'm curious to know. And I think that that's a virtue that we need to have. And I think that that's actually what will cause us to stand out from the intellectual elite of our day, that think predominantly in terms of their intellectual capability and not having a level of emotional intelligence as well. That, I think, is something that we can possess and match alongside our intellectual ability that makes us stand out. A second virtue that Daniel had was a sense of autonomy, which is a capacity for active, self-directed thinking, an ability to think and reason for himself. Daniel knew that they were not able to rely on the intellectual elite. They didn't have the answers. He was going to have to think for himself. He wasn't going to be able to tune in to whatever kind of intellectual, kind of elitist podcasters of the day in Babylon that he could maybe kind of pick up on and get some ideas and get some insight into what might be bothering the king. No, he would have to dig this out himself and figure it out. Okay. There was a sense of autonomy. Okay, the capacities for self-directed thinking. We live in a world where we're surrounded by so many voices, but the question is do you know how to think for yourself? Another virtue that Daniel had was courage, intellectual courage. Okay. The reality was that as the intellectual elite were not able to provide what the king was looking for, they were all running for the exits. They were all heading out of town because they knew that Nebuchadnezzar was going to be coming after all of them. And Daniel was part of that crowd. But while everybody else is running away, Daniel is running into. He's running into the place of danger because he is courageous. And so he has this readiness to persist in thinking or communicating even when there's the risk of danger, when there's the risk of thinking differently from everybody else and you might be ostracized. You might be in the crosshair of where the woke culture is at in your company or what have you, but you are willing to stand courageously and think independently of others. Another intellectual virtue that Daniel had was humility. Okay, look at how Daniel responds to having the insight that the king was looking for. He did not take credit for it himself. Okay, he recognizes it was a team of him and his brothers that stayed up all night. He recognizes that it's God who gives wisdom and insight to those that ask. And so that humility is a willingness to own one's intellectual limitations and mistakes, to be unconcerned with the intellectual status of prestige. Everybody else was concerned about their status and their prestige. Daniel wasn't. He had a humility of mind, not just a humility of heart, but he had a humility of mind. And I think in this day and age where there's so much information, everybody's got their opinion and all that, and everybody's so into leveraging that opinion as some kind of grand theory, you know, maybe a conspiracy, who knows, but a grand theory as to why things are the way they are. Oftentimes, there's so much pride that goes in with that it cuts us off from actually being able to be heard, because people see that and they see the pride and it closes a door of openness. And I think that leads to the last virtue, and that is open-mindedness. Okay. We know, as we look at the opening book, the opening chapter of Daniel, where Daniel is in Babylon, and his task is to read the language and the literature, not from Judah, not from the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, but he was to read the language and the literature of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians. He was to soak in the ideas of his day. Okay. And so that open-mindedness is where we are able to provide and receive a fair and honest consideration of different views. It's a willingness to change one's own opinion if and when necessary. That's open-mindedness. It's the ability to think through what others are saying who might not think the same as you, right? And we have to be so careful of our confirmation bias that we are only willing to listen to those sources that are going to confirm what I already believe. So those are the intellectual virtues that Daniel possessed. But in addition to that, he also possessed intellectual skills, not just virtues. Okay, I think those virtues are a central part of his intellectual character. And I think we need to think about that in terms of not just developing the skills that I'm about to kind of launch into, but especially because of the divisiveness of where we're at today. We need to be those who possess intellectual character, not just intellectual skill. Okay, and that's why these virtues are important. But let's move on to these intellectual skills. The verse that really sticks out to me in the first chapter of Daniel is verse 17. It's a verse that has spoken to me so specifically and profoundly over the years. It says, "As for these four youths," this is Daniel and his three friends from Judah that had been taken captive to Babylon. "As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom." Let me just focus here just for a moment, just personally. I came from a family that had a lot of intellectual kind of prowess. My parents were professors at universities in London. My father was a product of the University of Cambridge. As a young boy, he went to school at Cambridge University. And so I come from a family that has a lot of intellectual kind of culture that was formulated around that. And yet for me personally, I struggled in school. I was hopeless with my grades. I mean, if I still actually somewhere have my report cards, I kind of kept them just as a kind of a testimony of what God has done in my life. But I had C grades on my English and on my history, which is so ironic that I spent over 20 years of my life teaching history in university. But that wasn't my background. My background, in terms of for me personally, I struggled intellectually in a family environment where it was not okay to be struggling intellectually. And so for me, it was a badge of shame. And it wasn't until I got saved and I came into contact with this verse where it says, "God gave them skill in all learning and wisdom," that I realized that the intellectual giftings can be a gift from God. Yes, they need cultivating. Yes, they need work, but they are a gift that God gives. God gave them learning, which the word there in the Hebrew where it says gave, it means to cause to receive. My testimony is I prayed, "God, you need to cause me to receive knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, because I just don't get it. Even though I've come from this family background and there's shame affiliated with that, I don't get it." And I'll tell you right now, God is able to do that, and he desires for you to grow in these critical thinking skills. Well, let's unpack this a little bit. It says God gave them learning. Well, unpacking that word, the word learning comes from the Hebrew word mada, which means to discern, to distinguish, and to consider. Three really important intellectual skills that I think that we need to learn how to utilize. Discernment, the ability to distinguish, and the ability to consider. Let's first of all deal with the skill to discern. I think the objective here in this skill is the ability to understand the authority or the intent of why information is being created. Okay. And so in order for us to be able to discern things, we've got to ask some really serious questions when we are engaging in information and news and narratives and things of that nature. First of all, what level of authority and credibility does the author of the content actually have? Okay. I think our ability to discern truth from fiction, truth from narrative, truth from spin and so on, so much of that is going to be determined by the level of authority that person has. Okay? Now, lest we be careful, we've got to understand there is a difference between authority and intent. Okay? But because information is so easy to produce today because of all the technology, anybody can produce information. Anybody can create their own news channel. In fact, you know, if you just spend some time scrolling on YouTube, you'll find that it's just kind of pop-up shops all over the place, people with their home studios that are providing analysis of world affairs, of political scenarios that are playing out on the stage today, that are just coming out of people's ordinary garages. Like, who are these people? They are not authorities, I'll tell you that, okay? Another question to ask ourselves as we're discerning, to what extent do the author's views align with the authority of biblical principles, right? You guys are becoming well-versed in being able to spot that and to understand the alignment. And but just because somebody's views don't align with principles that are derived from the Bible doesn't mean that we don't listen to them, but it means that we are aware of that and we're able to understand that and see that right off the bat, and we're able to recognize what is missing, okay? Thirdly, and I think this is particularly important in today's era that we find ourselves in, do I feel emotionally manipulated by the author or by the headline, by the media itself? Is this information inciting an emotional response and making me angry, making me resentful, making me afraid? Okay, because I would hazard a guess that the vast majority of the news content that is being produced today, both in the mainstream media and also in the alternative media, and probably even more so in the alternative media, because they're trying to drum up so much audience all the time, that the audience doesn't just kind of come to them naturally, okay? That many of the narratives, many of the stories, much of the information is emotionally driven, okay? Emotionally driven. And that is of specific concern. And so you'll see very kind of epic headlines today, right? The end of democracy is designed to kind of evoke kind of a fear that democracy is about to crumble, right? And so it kind of garners our attention, okay? And so that leads, I think, to another question as we seek to discern, and that is, what appears to be the motivation of the author in providing this content? Everybody has a motivation. That's fine. That's real. Okay. The question is, are we able to discern it? Are we able to spot it? Okay. And are we able to figure out what it is that they're trying to do? Recognizing that information and media is now a currency of power, right? What is it that these people want power over, that they are utilizing the creation of their content in order to actually achieve, right? As long as we're aware and we're looking for that motivation, we should be really good at being able to spot it, okay? The second skill is the skill to distinguish. That is the understanding, the accuracy of the information. That's the objective of what we're trying to do when we're utilizing the skill of distinguishing things, okay? We're looking for the accuracy of information. So we're asking ourselves the questions like, where is this information sourced? Is it a reputable source, okay? Are these people, you know, considered reputable people that are speaking out on these particular issues and so on and so forth, okay? What evidence is being presented that supports their opinion? Having an opinion is fine. Are you presenting it with evidence? And is that evidence, you know, flaky or is it substantive? And in addition to that, and here's a question I think we have to get really good at, because there is so much misinformation and so many conspiracy theories out there, does the evidence sound plausible, exaggerated, realistic, okay? Oftentimes, if you think for a moment before just kind of jumping on an emotional bandwagon because everybody is saying that such and such and, a news story happened because of this nefarious thing. Well, is that even plausible? Why would such a political leader even want that reality? Perhaps, you know, think about their motives, right? And think about, is that really plausible? Maybe there's some truth to it, but it's being overly exaggerated in order to generate an emotional response or to get more attention, right? We all know, right? The immature people tend to exaggerate things, but that's what our children do, right? A sibling comes to us as a parent and says that, you know, and exaggerates the story of what their other sibling did in order to provoke a response from the parent and get them in trouble. That's what news creators and news purveyors do today. They exaggerate things in order to generate a response from you, okay? The third skill that we need to also be developing is the skill to consider. And the objective here is the recognition of how we're going to apply information, recognize the application of how that information can be used. We're considering information and we're thinking about how can this provide value? How can this be used to solve a problem? Okay? And so we ask questions there. To what extent can I agree or disagree with this information, right? In other words, I'm not just going to write it off because it happens to be a biased perspective. Instead, I'm going to think about it carefully and consider it and go, okay, well, how can I generate some value from this? Maybe I disagree fundamentally with the ethos or the conclusion of what this article is about or what this news piece is about. But it does provide me with some useful insight into why people think a particular way. Okay? And so I'm going to derive value from it. I'm going to subject myself to listening to it or reading it because I think, okay, I'm going to look for ways that I can find value in applying this. Okay? Another question, does this content foster discussion with those whom you may disagree? Or is this content so inflammatory and polarizing it's only going to divide us further? Okay. Oftentimes I find that material that is produced by the intellectual elite, as much as I may disagree with them on so many issues, it does foster discussion that is worthwhile. Okay. And it might not be as inflammatory as other sources of information that are maybe being provided by the alternative news media rather than the mainstream media, okay, oftentimes it's so hard to get into discussion with people because the information in the news is just so inflammatory and so polarizing, you know, internally as I'm listening to somebody kind of re-spout and re-share this kind of inflammatory information, I just kind of sit back and think to myself, you know what, it's not even worth engaging with the person around this because they're just not open to discussion. It's a closed door, okay? And so I want to be engaging information, articles, and analysis of what's going on around us from sources, even though I might disagree with them, I'm looking for content that's going to foster some really interesting discussion. Okay. Last question that I have is, how does this content help me understand others who are different from me and engage with them respectfully, even if I disagree? We live in polarizing times, okay? And it's imperative that we sit down and we seek empathy. We seek to understand. We seek to understand, why is it that people believe what they believe? Knowing full well, because we believe in the idea that the mind justifies what the heart has chosen, right? When we sit down with people, we're wanting to sit down and understand, why have they chosen to believe what they have believed? Because ultimately, that is an emotional choice. Okay. And so wise leaders can discern what is important. They can distinguish the difference between truth and opinion. And they can consider how to present information and knowledge in a way that provides practical value to others. That, I think, is our job in the information age that we find ourselves in. If we're going to be just another voice in this information age, we better get good at critical thinking, merged together with an emotional response that seeks to understand where people are truly at and where they are stuck, so that we can bring them a message that truly is different. It's different from the left and the right. It's different from the intellectual elites and those who are uneducated. This is the wisdom of God that brings transformation and problem solving into people's lives. Thank you for listening. I hope that you found this helpful, and I hope that it inspires you to be those who are going to become good and pay the price of gaining back your attention so that you can think critically.
This is a copyrighted program of Go Strategic, Santa Rosa, California. Unauthorized reproduction is prohibited. Go Strategic is an international nonprofit organization that educates and equips leaders and others for effective service and leadership using biblical principles. For more information, visit us online at www.gostrategic.org.